Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
We're in Numbers, chapter 1. The Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai in the tent of meeting on the first day of the second month in the second year after the exodus from the land of Egypt, saying, "Take a census of the entire assembly of the children of Israel, according to their families, according to their father's household, by number the names, every male according to their head count, from 20 years of age and up. Everyone who goes out to the legion in Israel, you shall count them according to their legions, you and Aaron. And with you shall be one man from each tribe, a man who is a leader of his father's household. These are the names of the men who shall stand with you. For Reuben, Eleazar, son of Shedeur. For Simeon, Shilmiel, son of Zurishaddai. For Judah, Nashon, son of Abinadab. For Issachar, Nethanel, son of Zuar. For Zebulun, Elab, son of Helon. For the children of Joseph, for Ephraim, Elishama, son of Amihud. For Manasseh, Gamaliel, son of Pedazur. For Benjamin, Abidan, son of Gidoni. For Dan, Ahizir, son of Amishaddai. For Asher, Pagil, son of Ochran. For Gad, Adisaph, son of Deuel. For Naphtali, Ahira, son of Enan. These are the ones summoned by the assembly, the leaders of their father's tribes. They are the heads of Israel's thousands. Moses and Aaron took these men who had been designated by their names. They gathered together the entire assembly on the first day of the second month, and they established their genealogy according to their families, according to their father's household, by number of the names, from 20 years of age and up, according to their head count. As the Lord had commanded Moses, he counted them in the wilderness of Sinai. These are the sons of Reuben, firstborn of Israel, their offspring according to their families, according to their father's household, by number of the names according to their head count. Every male from 20 years of age and up, everyone who goes out to the legion. Their count for the tribe of Reuben, 46,500. The sons of Simeon, their offspring, according to their families, according to their father's household, its numbers by the number of the names, according to their head count, every male from 20 years of age and up, everyone who goes out to the legion, their count, the tribe of Simeon, 59,300. The sons of Gad, their offspring, according to their families, according to their father's household, by number of names, from 20 years of age and up, everyone who goes out to the legion, their count, the tribe of Gad, 45,650. The sons of Judah, their offspring, according to their families, according to their father's household, by number of the names, from 20 years of age and up, everyone who goes out to legion, their count, the tribe of Judah, 74,600. For the sons of Issachar, their offspring, according to their families, according to their father's household, by number of the names, from 20 years of age and up, everyone who goes out to legion, their count, the tribe of Issachar, is 54,400. The sons of Zebulun, their offspring according to their families, according to their father's household, by number of the names from 20 years of age and up, everyone who goes out to legion, their count, the tribe of Zebulun, 57,400. The sons of Joseph, for the sons of Ephraim, their offspring according to their families, according to their father's household, by number of the names from 20 years of age and up, everyone who goes out to legion, their count, the tribe of Ephraim, 40,500. The sons of Manasseh, their offspring, according to their families, according to their father's households, by number of the names, from 20 years of age and up, everyone who goes out to legion, their count for the tribe of Manasseh, 32,200. The sons of Benjamin, their offspring, according to their families, according to their father's household, by number of their names, from 20 years of age and up, everyone who goes out to legion, their count for the tribe of Benjamin, 35,400. The sons of Dan, their offspring, according to their families, according to their father's household, by number of their names, from 20 years of age and up, everyone who goes out to legion, their count, the tribe of Dan, 62,700. The sons of Asher, their offspring, according to their families, according to their father's household, by numbers of their names. From 20 years of age and up, everyone who goes out to the legion, their count, the tribe of Asher, 41,500. The sons of Naphtali, their offspring, according to their families, according to their father's households, by number of their names, from 22 years of age and up, everyone who goes out to the legion, their count, the tribe of Naphtali, 53,400. These are the countings that Moses, Aaron, and the leaders of Israel counted. 12 men, one man for his father's household, were they. These were all the countings of the children of Israel, according to their father's households, from 20 years of age and up. Everyone goes out to the legion of Israel. All their countings were 603,550. The Levites, according to their father's tribe, were not counted among them. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "But you shall not count the tribe of Levi. You shall not take a census of them among the children of Israel. Now you appoint the Levites over the temple, or the tabernacle of the testimony, over all its utensils, and over everything that belongs to it. They shall carry the tabernacle and all its utensils, and they shall minister to it. They shall encamp around the tabernacle. The tabernacle journeys, Levites shall take it down. The tabernacle encamps, Levites shall erect it. An alien who approaches shall die. The children of Israel shall encamp, every man in his camp, every man at his banner, according to their legions. The Levites shall camp around the tabernacle of the testimony, so that there shall be no wrath upon the assembly of the children of Israel. And Levites shall safeguard the watch of the tabernacle of the testimony. The children of Israel did everything the Lord commanded Moses, so did they do." Chapter 2. "The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, 'The children of Israel shall encamp, each man by his banner, according to the insignias of their father's household. At a distance surrounding the tent of meeting shall they encamp. Those who encamp to the front at the east shall be the banner of the camp of Judah, according to their legions. The leader of the children of Judah is Nahshon, son of Abinadab. His legion and their count are 74,600. Those encamping near him are the tribe of Issachar. The leader of the children of Issachar is Nethaneel, son of Zuar. And his legion and their count are 54,400. The tribe is Zebulun. And the leader of the children of Zebulun is Eliab, son of Helon. Its legion and their count are 57,400. All those counted for the camp of Judah are 186,400. According to your legions, they shall be the first to journey. The banner of the camp of Reuben shall be to the south, according to their legions. The leader of the children of Reuben is Elizur, son of Shedur. Its legion and their count are 46,500. Those encamping near him, a tribe of Simeon, and the leader of the children of Simeon is Shilumil, son of Zurishaddai. Its legion and their count are 59,300. And the tribe of Gad, the leader of Gad, the children of Gad, is Elisaph, son of Reuel. Its legion and their count are 45,650. All those counted for the camp of Reuben are 151,450. According to their legions, they shall be second to journey. The tent of meeting, the camp of Levites, shall journey in the middle of the camps. As they encamp, so shall they journey, everyone at his place, according to their banners. The banner of the camp of Ephraim, according to their legions, shall be to the west. The leader of the children of Ephraim is Elishama, son of Amihud. Its legion and their count are 40,500. Those near him, a tribe of Manasseh. The leader of the children of Manasseh is Gamaliel, son of Pedahzur. Its legion and their count are 32,200. And the tribe of Benjamin. The leader of the children of Benjamin is Abidan, son of Gideoni. His legion and the count are 35,400. All those counted for the camp of Ephraim are 108,100 according to the legions. They should be third to journey. The banner of the camp of Dan should be to the north, according to their legion. And the leader of the children of Dan is Ahizir, son of Amishaddai. Its legion and their count are 62,700. Those that can be near him, the tribe of Asher. The leader of the children of Asher is Pagaliel, son of Akron. Its legion and their count are 41,500. The tribe of Naphtali, and the leader of the children of Naphtali, is Ahir, son of Enan. Its legion and their count are 53,400. All those counted for the camp of Dan are 157,600. They should be the last to journey according to their banners. These are the countings of the children of Israel according to their father's households. All the countings of the camps according to their legions, 603,550. The Levites were not counted among the children of Israel, as the Lord had commanded Moses. The children of Israel did everything the Lord had commanded Moses. So they encamped according to their banners, and so they journeyed, every man according to his family, by his father's household. Chapter 3. These the offspring of Aaron and Moses, on the day the Lord spoke with Moses at Mount Sinai. These the names of the sons of Aaron. The firstborn was Nadab and Abihu, Eleazar and Itamar. These the names of the sons of Aaron, anointed Kohanim, whom he inaugurated to minister. Nadab and Abihu died before the Lord when they offered an alien fire before the Lord in the wilderness of Sinai, and they had no children. But Eleazar and Itamar ministered during the lifetime of Aaron, their father. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Bring near the tribe of Levi, and have it stand before Aaron the Kohen, and they shall serve him. They shall safeguard his charge and the charge of the entire assembly before the tent of meeting, to perform the service of the tabernacle. They shall safeguard all the utensils of the tent of meeting and the charge of the children of Israel to perform the service of the tabernacle. You shall present the Levites to Aaron and his sons. Presented, they are presented to him. For the children of Israel, you shall appoint Aaron and his sons, and they shall safeguard their priesthood, and the alien who approaches will die." The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Behold, I have taken the Levites from among the children of Israel in place of every firstborn. The first issue of a womb among the children of Israel and the Levites shall be mine. For every firstborn is mine. On the day I struck down every firstborn in the land of Egypt, I sanctified every firstborn in Israel for myself. From man to beast, they shall be mine. I am the Lord." The Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, saying, "Count the sons of Levi, according to their father's household, according to their families. Every male from 1 month of age and up shall you count them." Moses counted according to the word of the Lord as he had been commanded. These are the sons of Levi by their names, Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. These are the sons of Gershon according to their families, Libni and Shimei. The sons of Kohath according to their families were Amram, Izhar, Hebron, and Uziel. The sons of Merari according to their families were Mali and Mushi. These are the families of Levi according to their father's household. Gershon had the family of the Levites, the family of Shemites, and the family of Gershonites. Their count, according to the number, every male from 1 month of age and up, their count was 7,500. The Gershonite families would encamp behind the tabernacle to the west. The leader of the father's household, the Gershonites, was Eliasaf, son of Leu. The charge of the Gershonites in the tent of meeting was the tabernacle, the tent, its cover, the screen of the entrance to the tent of meeting, the curtains of the courtyard, the screens of the entrance of the courtyard that surround the tabernacle and the altar, its ropes for all of its labor. Kohath had the family of Amorites, the family of Izharites, the family of Hebronites, the family of Uzalites. These were the Kohathite families. The number of every male from 1 month of age and up was 8,600. The guardians, the children, guardians of the charge of sanctity, the families of the children of Kohath would encamp on the side of the tabernacle to the south. The leader of the father's house of the Kohathites was Elzaphan, son of Uziel. Their charge was the ark, the table, the menorah, the altars, the sacred utensils with which they would minister, the partition, and all of its accessories. The leader of the Levite leaders was Eleazar, son of Aaron, the Kohen. The assignment of the guardians of the charge of sanctity. Merari had the family of the Mahalites and the family of Mushites. These were Merarite families. Their count, according to their number, every male from 1 month of age and up, was 6,200. The leader of the father's household of the Merarites was Zuriel, son of Abihail. They would encamp on the side of the tabernacle to the north. The assignment of the charge of the sons of Merari was the planks of the tabernacle, its bars, its pillars, its sockets, and all its utensils, and all of its accessories. The pillars of the courtyard all around their sockets, their pegs, and their ropes. Those who encamped before the tabernacle to the front, before the tent of meeting to the east, were Moses, Aaron, and his sons, guardians of the charge of sanctuary. For the charge of the children of Israel, any alien who approaches shall die. All the counties of Levites which Moses and Aaron counted by the word of the Lord, according to their families, every male from 1 month of age and up, were 22,000. The Lord spoke to Moses, count every firstborn male, the children of Israel, from 1 month of age and up. Take a census of their names. You shall take the Levites for me, I, the Lord, in place of every firstborn of the children of Israel, and the livestock of the Levites in place of every firstborn of the animals of the children of Israel. Moses counted, as the Lord had commanded him, every firstborn of the children of Israel, every firstborn male, according to the number of their names, from 1 month of age and up, according to the numbers, was 22,273. The Lord said to Moses, saying, take the Levites in place of every firstborn of the children of Israel, and the livestock Levites in place of their livestock, and Levites shall be mine, I am the Lord. As for the redemptions of the 273 of the firstborn of the children of Israel, who were in excess of the Levites, you shall take 5 shekels each, according to head count, and the sacred shekel shall you take. Shekel is 20 gerahs. You shall give the money to Aaron and his sons as redemption price of the additional ones among them. Moses took the money of the redemption from those who were in excess of the redemptions of the Levites. For the firstborn children of Israel, he took the money, 1,365, in the sacred shekels. Moses gave the money to the redemptions to Aaron and to his sons, according to the word of the Lord, as the Lord commanded Moses. Chapter 4. Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, take a census the sons of Kohath from among the sons of Levi, according to their families, according to their father's household, from 30 years of age and up, until 50 years of age. Everyone who comes to legion to perform work in the tent of meeting. This is the work of the sons of Kohath in the tent of meeting, the most holy. When the camp is a journey, Aaron and his sons shall come, take down the partition curtain and cover the Ark of Testimony with it. They shall place on it a tekoah hide covering and spread a cloth entirely of turquoise wool over it and adjusted staves. Upon the table of the showbread, they shall spread a cloth of turquoise wool and place upon it dishes, the spoons, the pillars, the shelving tubes, and the constant bread shall remain on it. They shall place over them a cloth of scarlet wool and cover it with cover of tekoah hide and in place its staves. They shall place a cloth of turquoise wool over the menorah of illumination and its lamps, its tongs, its spoons, and all the vessels of its oil with which they minister to it. They shall place it and all its utensils into a cover of tekoah hide and place it on the pole. Upon the gold altar, they shall spread a cloth of turquoise wool and cover it with a covering of tekash hide, and in place its staves. They shall take all the utensils of the service with which they serve in the sanctuary, and place them on a cloth of turquoise wool, and cover them with a covering of tekash hide, and place them on the pole. They shall clear the ash from the altar, and spread a cloth of purple wool over it. They shall place upon it all the utensils with which they minister upon it, the fire pans, the forks, the shovels, the basins, all the utensils of the altar, and spread over it a covering of tekash hide, and in place its staves. Aaron and his sons shall finish covering the holy and the holy utensils when the camps journey, and then the sons of Kohath shall come and carry, so they do not touch the sanctuary and die, lest the burden of the sons of Kohath in the tent of meeting. The charge of Eleazar, son of Aaron, the Kohen, is the oil of illumination, the incense spices, the meal offering, or the continual offering, and the anointment oil, the charge of the entire tabernacle and everything in it, of the sanctuary and all its utensils. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Do not let the tribe of Kohath families be cut off from among Levites. Thus you shall do for them, so that they shall live and not die. When they approach the Holy of Holies, Aaron and his sons shall come and assign them every man to his work and his burden. But they shall not come and look as the holy is inserted, lest they die." That was Numbers 1 through 4, verse 20. Although David Barr. Counting. Any questions, comments, things that got your attention about this section? It's a lot of reading, a lot of numbers, tons and tons of numbers. Yes, Louise.
I never did understand the part about exchanging the firstborn to the Levites. There were more of one than the other, and they had to pay the ransom, whatever.
Right, the ransom.
I don't understand it. Could you explain
I'll see if I can try to explain that to you.
Yeah, okay.
I'll do my best. It's not easy. So in the exchange, so when God came along and the Egyptians, and he whacked the firstborn of the Egyptians, right? Well, every human belongs to God. He created all of us, right? So he comes along and he has to kill some of his children, the firstborn of Egypt. He kills them in order to free the Israelites out. But they're all God's children. So God made a purchase. He purchased the lives through lives. He purchased Israel through the lives of the children of Egypt. So God purchased somebody. He purchased Israel by killing Egypt. Not just Egypt. Egypt specifically the firstborn of Egypt. That was the price tag. Well, now that God killed all these people, who's going to pay for their murders? Who's going to make them free? They're all dead. Well, God said, this is how I'm going to handle this situation. I wiped out the firstborn of Egypt that night. In place of them, I will lift up the firstborn of Israel in place of them. So as a result, he said, okay, the firstborn, because he says all the firstborn of Israel, both man and beast, belong to me. That's what we just read that. So he said all firstborn, that's a one. All firstborn of Israel, all of them belong to God. That was his exchange. If I'm going to sacrifice these firstborn of Egypt, I'm going to take the firstborn of Israel as mine in exchange. That was the deal. But he also said, instead of me taking every firstborn male among you, from Reuben and Judah and everybody else there was, I'm going to tell you all, I will do an exchange. Instead of taking each of you firstborn sons, which how many of you are firstborn sons? Well, you might be. Yeah, guess what? You'd be gone. Y'all be gone. Instead of taking you individually, I'm going to do an exchange. Just like I exchange the firstborn of Egypt for the firstborn of Israel, I'm going to exchange Levi, the whole tribe, for the firstborn of Israel. So he did this exchange by killing the Egyptians. Then he does another exchange. In exchange for this detail, I'm going to take Levi in place of the firstborn of Israel. So he's basically just doing a swap. Hey, I killed Egypt, you owe me Israel, I got you free, I killed a lot of people, you're paying for it. How you pay for it? I'm going to take your firstborn. Not killing them, but use them as service to me. But instead of me taking the service of every single one of the firstborn and all the animals firstborn, I'm going to do an exchange to taking all of you individually, which is very complicated to figure all out. I'm going to take just the whole unit tribe of Levi out of you. This will be mine in that exchange detail. So he's showing mercy upon each of the tribes, so you can keep your firstborn sons, but I'm taking this entire tribe as mine to serve me, as in payment for me killing the firstborn of Egypt. And I'm not going to kill Levi, they're going to work for me all their days. Hold on, hands are up. David's hand was first, go ahead.
Just two things. First thing is, I don't know why these, I'm assuming these numbers were rounded off because they're all 500, not 531
right,
or 537.
Right, they're all rounded off numbers, yes.
So it seems like somebody rounded them off.
And yes, they
so
are rounded.
That kind of raised some suspicion. But the point that I was curious about is the wording where it says, whoever was able to go out to war.
Yes.
And then in Deuteronomy, we know that a year after marriage, they're not, you know, they're to stay home and not go to war.
Right. There are limits.
So
right.
I'm guessing that that's why that wording is in there, because
it's
of the Deuteronomy
that.
Torah, or is
well,
there
other
reasons?
There's other reasons too.
That's what I want
somebody,
to know.
Somebody could be incapable of going to war. I'm missing an arm. Don't put him to war. I'm not likely to win. Just saying. Yo, so with two arms attacking me and I got one arm to... which one's going to carry the sword? This arm or the shield? I'm not going to succeed. So I am not capable, if I was missing an arm, of going to war to fight for my country. It just wouldn't work. Because I'm at a distinct disadvantage. Either I just have a sword or I just have a shield, and either way I'm not going to live long. So I would not be functionally able to do so. I have a broken body part. Again, I can't function. Mind you, we don't have modern medicine back then. When you break something, it causes lasting problems. It's the, oh, let's just reset it, put a cast on it, you know, you inject it with some painkillers. It doesn't have that option. It's, oh, it's broken. Oh, that's too bad for you. Let's move on. That kind of lifestyle of how you deal with things. You also have illnesses that are permanent or debilitating. Well, that's a reason why somebody cannot physically go to war. Elderly, of course, are not able to go to war either for various reasons, mostly because they physically couldn't do much. So they have limits of nobody under the age of 20 is permitted to be going to war. Their cutoff is 20. And up is permitted. But up to a point, if you physically aren't able, you're out. And it may be a temporary unable, or it might be a permanent unable. In this particular count, any temporary unables generally are assumed to have still been counted, because they're temporary. I broke a finger. It hurts now, but give me a few weeks, I'll be fine. That'd be a temporary thing. A permanent thing, I'm missing an arm. Okay, let's not count the missing arm guys. Let them go home. So there are different things which you would include and which would not include. Make sense? So temporary things, you would still include them, this tradition. Permanent things, you do not include because they're not useful to you in war. They may do something else, but not useful to you in that capacity. And elderly... Are you not going to put a 90-year-old man against a 25-year-old, you know, warrior? Just not going to end well for the 90-year-old guy. So they have those limitations as well. Yes, David.
I'd like to return back to the firstborn comment for a second, because it seems very significant, this exchange, that he took the firstborn, getting them out of Egypt. And they could have very easily said, oh, this is the new way we relate to our God. All our firstborn now have to be sacrificed. But he didn't do that. It was still the same generation when he declared this exchange.
Yes.
And so he put an end to violence in that offering, in that position.
End to violence. Oh, as in killing the person. Oh, right. Yes, you could, yeah, right. Other cultures would have literally burned their firstborn up. You're right. Yes, it would be end to that quickly.
To their creating that type of tradition.
Right. It was purposely not to be done that way. Which if you had just read the story of Abraham and Isaac and just then stopped there, you'd think, sacrificing his firstborn might still be okay, acceptable. Well, God spared Isaac, but it doesn't mean I shouldn't do it. So do you have a learning instruction process through how he was going through? Now, don't get me wrong, many people wind up killing their firstborn throughout the story of the Bible for various reasons. Sacrifice this God, that God, whatever. Well, that still did happen. It was not God's way. It was purposely said, this is abhorrent to me, evil in every way imaginable, but that's what people still sometimes did, because human sacrifice was still relatively common. So this is not, but the idea of what was going on here, that God killed a whole bunch of people, he owns you now, and now he's going to say, now how am I going to facilitate this ownership? It's not a kill the bodies for me, I don't want to kill the firstborn, I want to burn up all the firstborn people, none of that nature, I'm going to make them work for me, and Levi had a consequence. You own nothing. There's no inheritance, no property. You own nothing. You have the house you used to live in, that's about it. So you don't get to have prosperous and have lots of accumulate lots of wealth. No, that's not part of your deal. You're working until you die. That's kind of how it was supposed to. Or you're working until you're 50 years old. And then 50 years old beyond that, you're teaching everybody else how to do your job because you're still working. Levi has an age range of 30 to 50 of their time slot of actual physical nonstop labor in the temple. That makes sense. But then they have other things to do before and afterward, which is also included as well. Yes, Anne.
Are we going to talk about redemption and the amount of money?
Yes, a little bit. not necessarily the amount as far as the 5 shekels necessarily, but as far as the redemption process. So, I forgot which chapter it is. I've forgotten. Anyway, what chapter? I think we just recently read it too. About the firstborn, you will redeem. Firstborn sons, you redeem. It's something in Leviticus. Firstborn sons, if your firstborn son, you will redeem from God. It's a certain price tag. Is it 5 shekels? I can't remember. Any firstborn of a donkey, if you don't redeem the firstborn donkey, you have to break its neck. That's how the instructions. Any firstborn of a clean animal, you don't get to redeem. That's God's. He just used the clean animals for both for sacrifices or for Levi or whatever he's doing. That's part of the payment, so to speak. So no matter what happens, a firstborn still belongs to God, in spite of the fact he said he's taking Levi in their place. He said Levi to serve him in their place. But the firstborn that come later, those all still belong to God too. All right? He's making this exchange has to continuously happen always, even from generation to generation. The firstborn exchange has to keep on going. In this instance, we have the 273 extra people. That exchange starts there. Here's the 5 shekel fee. And then let's continue on and go through this process of every generation following. You always have this exchange price. Yes.
And this is just me. That doesn't sit right with me. It's like you're continuously forced into labor. For all your life, you have to give your animals up way over and above what happened in Egypt. It doesn't seem right to me.
And the idea of what we think of right and what God thinks right is the same thing. Let's draw it over here real quick. So, unfair.
If there's people being enslaved, slavery.
I don't call it slavery, but that's fine. That's fine. Each you have your own term. I call it service, but that's okay. So, let's do this in the alternate scenario, just a one time, which didn't happen. Just how it's going to work. Let's pretend for a moment when Egypt took place and the death of the firstborn. That was a one-time event and only applied that one event, which is when he killed all these people. So every subsequent event generation, let's pretend it didn't happen as far as there's no new firstborn belonging to God, whatever. I'm going to throw out junk garbage numbers, okay? Let's pretend God killed 10,000 firstborn Egyptians. Well, the fair exchange, 10,000 Levites or 10,000 firstborn of Israel should work for him because, it's a straight, one-to-one relationship. So put over here, so firstborn of Israel. And put 10,000. That's a one-time event. God killed these firstborn, I make these firstborn work for me. Well, here's the problem with this firstborn that God killed. If they had grown up, how many children would they have had? Two, three, four apiece? Probably. A lot of, no, birth control. So let's pretend these firstborn, had they grown up and they had wives and children of their own, let's say one generation passed. Let's give them, I'm being conservative, we'll say there's 40,000 children that would have come from the next generation from these 10,000 being born. Well, if this happened of Israel, the first one of Israel, God is now missing 40,000 people. Because note, these generations, you'll live and you'll die. You got, what, 70 years and you're dead, give or take, right? So after 70 years, this exchange would go away. But God didn't just kill these 10,000 people. I'm using the firstborn of Israel. He killed every generation that follows. There are millions, millions of missing people that would have come from this firstborn of Egypt. Go ahead.
I have been told that once a baby dies, that's it.
Your mother told me that.
Once a baby dies, that's it.
Dies in utero or whatever, they don't count. That's what she told me, that the babies don't count. That they flat out don't count. There's
don't
no,
count
they
what?
Don't. They don't come back. They don't get to go to heaven or whatever it is that happens afterwards.
Oh.
So if you're counting the unborn dead, then that shouldn't count if she's correct.
Well, I will not discuss the details which you have with my mother and far as her opinions. I'm not arguing with that. My point is that these people, God, when he killed this 10,000, he killed generations as well. Many generations in the process. This is not, it's not a man killing the man fighting. That's men to men. This is God coming in, and mind you, can you stop God from killing you? Of course not. Can you stop a man killing you? Yes, fight back. But you can't stop God. This is beyond your ability to do anything about it. These 10,000, they don't have a choice in the matter of dying. They're going to die. They can't say, oh, well, not me. No, God said, I'm killing you anyway. So these are God-executed individuals. Well, in God-executed individuals, there's lots of generations to follow, too. Well, in Israel, if he did this, the 1 10,000 exchange, when these guys die 70 years later, does he have any servants left? Nope. What happens to the temple? It rots. Turns to dirt. That's it. Well, what happens? So would God have any priests? No. Would they have anybody else at all? No. Would anybody know about God? No. Because they're all dead. So it can't be a one-time exchange. It has to be a generational exchange. Else you and I wouldn't have this book. We have no knowledge of them at all. So God has to be counting not just the generation now, but all the future generations too, because he's counting on them learning and reading also. He preserved it, this book that we have to read from, by this process.
Does that mean unborn babies count?
Between your discussion with my mother regarding unborn babies and how they're counting, I can't speak to. But I can speak as far as generational, it still adds up.
They're counting
years. All firstborn from 1 month and old are God's. If a baby dies 4 months old, he wouldn't have been counted anyway. Because it's too young. He would not be counted as firstborn belonging to God. Because he says 1 month and up. Yes.
God takes murder very seriously.
Yes.
Because when Cain killed Abel, he didn't just kill Abel, he killed all the generations that would have ever come from him. Mm-hmm. You know, and so even like when you're looking at this, so when God had to kill the firstborn of Egypt, all those generations were never born, and God is also taking that seriously.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
And he's wanting Israel to understand how serious it is. This is not just a one-time thing that, oh yeah, you know, I had to kill the firstborn of Israel, 4,000 years ago or whatever it was. Because those generations will never be born. Just study your genealogy sometime and figure out how many people had to have been born for you to be born.
Yeah.
And you realize that if any one of those people had not
made it,
you would not be here.
Yeah, hundreds if not thousands of people, depending on who you are and the frequency of birth process. So this firstborn was supposed to be a continuous cycle. Yes.
I'm thinking also we have to think about the fact that being a servant was a blessing.
Yeah, it's not a curse.
It's a wonderful thing to be. That's what we're all trying to do, after all. And so those people that were forced because they were Levites into being servants in the temple were blessed by that. So it's not like it's a bad thing to be God's servant.
It isn't. And that's part. Yeah, they didn't have to go to war. That's true. They didn't have to go to war. There's some perks, you know? Hopefully this kind of makes sense as far as what we're discussing, as far as why it was a continuous cycle that wasn't supposed to end. Because if it did end, we wouldn't have Bibles, we wouldn't have a side, we wouldn't have anything, because we have no knowledge of it at all. It'll all be a one-time event. So he must be continually counting, because that's how we got our books that we have, because this continuous cycle. Who kept these books? Who kept the records? These people, the Levites. They're the ones who kept them all. So they're the ones who preserved them, translated them, distributed them, made them by languages, taught people about God. They did all the work. Well, God meant that service to continue on, just like you teach your children. If you perish the day your children are born, what do you get to teach them? Nothing. Somebody else hopefully will, but you wouldn't teach them anything. So this cycle is a future, never-ending process. Hope that makes sense. Okay, let's continue on here. Oh, any other questions or comments? Yes.
Christians like to say we're not all God's children.
That's a phrase. It's a quote.
You just mean in the sense that God created all of us.
Okay.
I mean, is that what you mean?
All
when
humans.
You, is that
no,
when
all
you
humans,
said we're all God's children?
Yeah, every human who came from Adam and Eve, and find me one who didn't. I'm curious. Are all creations that God created Adam and Eve to start with. So all of us became his children. What defines someone as a follower of God, a son of God, is different than his generalized children. His generalized children include all humans, because every human he created is his. From Adam and Eve onward, he built them all through. What Christians usually jump into, not all people are God's children, refer to, are they all sons of God? Meaning, are they all followers of God's instruction or not? That is not necessarily the case. Look around you. We can see that that's obviously the case in the world. Many people, children of God, do not follow him. They have no knowledge of him at all. They don't even care. They're doing their own religious beliefs, which is fine. That's what they do. But there are different groups in that category. It's a quote. See, Paul says it. Not all of Israel are of Israel, or something like that. How he phrases it exactly. But not all the sons of Israel belong to God, the promise that God was going to give. Only the one from Jacob, not Esau, that came through. Not Israel, sorry, of Isaac. They're all the different sons came through different ways, and they all grew and produced. Not all of them follow God, but they're all still God's children. Yes.
Well, I was just, thinking also in the context of, depending on who you call Christian and what era this is all coming from and timing, if you go back to, Judaism and their thought, they were the chosen people. They were the sons of God. They didn't understand individual salvation. It was group. If you were born into it, keeping the Torah and all these things. And I think that caused a lot of problem there with the circumcision parties and all that. Fast forward to Paul and his writings, and here we are today.
Right.
Gentiles welcomed into the tribe.
Right, right. So we're going to talk about that topic actually a bit today, because that's a lot of how these tribes are arranged and done in this tabernacle cycle and how they're camped and what that means to someone who is not a biological descendant of. But how would we get in? We'll discuss that as well. Any other comments or questions? Yes, Deborah.
Well, I know that they were not Jews. There were 12 tribes, and so all of them, you search out their words, the different functions of what their names mean, how they're set out, and they're the first dispatched, and they protect. I forgot my notes. Oh, I'm such a bummed out. It's making my neck hurt.
That's okay.
Sorry, my neck. The way that they were dispatched out, and it's how the brain works, how we execute a functioning, and then because I think God has made this plan and he's going to, it's going to be so right in front of our eyes. It's going to be amazing, like how our body works, how our mind works. And then the way I looked those tribes up, it was amazing how that was. And the responsibility of them as the Hebrew people to carry that out, to live and die, to bring these words to us. And they were responsible for feeding the nations. And that's why they were always severely punished as 12 tribes. They were severely punished because they was their responsible to bring a light to the nations.
Yeah.
And so, and the way that they were dispatched, it's amazing the story when you can get it. But when you have so many different people's opinions and so-and-so said without the facts, it makes it very difficult to, you have to use a lot of discernment. So I'm really glad that we're here to have these discussions. It helps us to have understanding.
The alternate viewpoints. Okay. Let's continue on with this then. Any questions or comments? Okay. All right. Bimibar, the counting cycle. I'm not going through every detail. We talked a number of things already so far. But obviously this is a census that's taking place. So the census, as it points out, it was not inclusive of Levite initially. So I'm not going to write down every number. It's not important. Roughly 70 people. Wrong marker color. 70 people went into Egypt to start with. That was roughly 210 to 220 years earlier. 70 people went into Egypt to start with. 70 people went in. And now we got with 600,000 men. Wives, you got probably another 600,000. Children, probably another, I don't know. Most of these people had about 4 to 5 kids apiece. Yeah. So, Benjamin was excessive. He had a lot. But not all of them had that many. He had a lot of sons. And most of the names are only recorded. Most of them just record their sons anyway. So I'm just, roughly, we'll just double it times two. So, 2.4 million, roughly. I will not discuss how 70 produced 2.4 million. Doesn't matter. Not part of our discussion today. But lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of people. Tons of people. So it's a short period of time, a couple hundred years, but they produce a whole bunch. Every tribe has their own groupings, and they all break down as far as where they all come from. Note that what he had to do for the counting process, what was the fee to be counted? Remember what the fee was? It's a half shekel, close, shekel, half shekel. So each male, this is males from all of Israel, not including Levi. So each male has a half shekel as a fee. What is the fee called? It's called an atonement fee. So an atonement fee, because being counted is not necessarily a positive thing. God doesn't like census. Just in case you run across that, the Bible and the Torah periodically says, don't count them, don't count them. Counting them is wrong, don't count them. He gets to count them and nobody else gets to count them. So, half shekel fee. So what's the process? They take the half shekels and then count the half shekels. That's the way which you avoid counting the individual people. But what I want to point out to you, one of the statements here, it says over and over again, it says as they're counting from them, oops, back a little bit here. What all do they count? Not just their heads, like the actual 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, but they actually count by their names. So each person's count includes his name. Name, his personal name and what his dad's name is, the parent's name. So name plus father. It's an important concept. It means, as far as we look at this, means that each individual person is a valuable thing. I can just count how many kids I have in my family. I got 5 children. Let's say you have 5. However, say I have firstborn son Isaac, I've got Samara, secondborn, I've got Rivka, and then I've got Yosef and Hannah. Now I applied names to them, gave you more information, made each individual of my children an identity. It gives, as opposed to just a number, I'm number 3, I'm number 7, I'm number 12. No. Yeah. You actually have a name. It means that you have value. So when we deal with names, and God says that you will record everyone's name according to their names, according to their father's households, he's meaning write down the important person. This is an identity, not just a number. This means something to someone. In particular, this case is to God. So it's important we focus that this is not just a number count. These are actually names being recorded. Now, where are they all recorded? I don't know. But they're all being recorded according to each father's household, according to each tribe. So they have the genealogy of each tribe, each individual person has been or is being recorded. Yes, Luis.
Who gets the fee?
Oh, the fee, the half shekel all goes to Levi. So Aaron, in this particular instance, Aaron, Moses, and each of the heads of tribes. So there was a total of 14 men doing the counting job.
Did some of the shekels also go to the making of the tabernacle?
They would have, yes. Which was part of the manufacturing process, as far as you got the fees for each of them, which were used by the Levites to actually build these parts and pay for the individuals to use them. So, for example, you've got, if I've got, I'm just arbitrarily, so I got, 600,000 half shekels of silver, assuming it's silver. So, say if it's 600,000, I can melt some of them into a product, or I can buy something from somebody else or pay them for their service for what the work they're doing. Either way, it's still being used. The Levites have to choose how am I using the 600,000 half shekels? Am I going to melt them down, which in some cases they did, or am I going to use it to pay someone to buy supplies or pay them for their service? Different things which you can use it for. It was Levites' discretion on how they were going to use the half shekel process. In this instance, when you add up the actual weights of each of the planks and all the different what you call it, the plugs, the sockets they fit inside of. The weights aren't quite right for the amount of money they collected. They're pretty close on most things, but one of them is a little off. In particular, the half shekel count, the silver, is off on what they used versus how much they collected. I'm not going to discuss how that all happened because it's not part of this Torah portion today. That has to do with how the weight, I think it was one talent per socket, I guess what the weight was. And you add them all up based on the amount of silver they received, both in this half shekel event, as well as the donations received, doesn't actually add up to the one talent amount used. I won't discuss how it all adds up today, but that there's some of it was melted down, some of it may have been used to pay for the services for what they happened to have been. The Israelites were supposed to build this whole thing and have all the supplies they needed to build it with. But it's possible that they have all the supplies or something they had to purchase from traders going back and forth. Mind you, if there was 2.4 million people, there'd be a lot of money there. If I was a caravan owner, I'd say, okay, buddy, we're heading here. Because there's lots and lots of supplies. They have no farmland. I'll bring all my stuff and I'll sell them. I'll make a mint, literally. I don't know what this is going to be, how I'd make out of it. So there's lots of money here to be used. And they all borrowed permanently without asking. They did ask, actually. Permanently. They collected the paper from Egypt. So they had lots of money to work with. Anyway, let's move on. So each name is important. So God made sure they recorded each of their names. Hence, when Moses was told to count the Levites by the 1 month and old, and he said, okay, compare that to the firstborns. Well, he already had a list of the names of all the descendancy of the first count. He would just go through his list and add up the firstborn based on the names he had. So you can do that math, instead of having to recount everybody a second time, which would be of impractical use. Yes, Anne. Well, he's coming with the recording device.
So this kind of negates the idea that a Jew is according to his mother.
Ah, that we're talking about that. Actually, we're going into that topic just shortly. I can go. Actually, might as well go with it just about now. Not quite yet. I'll get that topic in a minute. There's something else I want to discuss, or briefly first. I don't need this part over here, so I'm going to flip it around. So I'm not going to draw every little detail, but as far as a generalized map of how these tribes were all broken up, so you have the rectangular, or some, now some guy said it was round shape. Anyway, it's square, rectangular to me. The tabernacle in the middle, facing east. You have a north, a east, south, and west. Rectangular or square shape, I don't really care. This is traditionally it's rectangular, but you could argue it's round or square or upside down, inverted. I don't really care. Make it a triangle if they want to. The point is, you have different sides. Oh, hey, yes, right. He has a little map here. That makes life simpler for me. I don't have to draw it that way. Is it on? Hey, it's on. Yay. Okay. So a little map up here, which Jeff so kindly put up here. He has obviously the individual tribes in the north, south, east, and west. In this instance, the one over here off the side, which is off the sheet here, this is Moses, Aaron, and his sons. Let me get my pencil. Here it is. Oh, thank you. Moses, Aaron, and Aaron's sons are all hanging out in this generalized area. So you have, they are all there hanging out near the entrance. This is the main entrance to the tabernacle itself. So they all come through here. You also have the tribes on the outside of them, which is further east in their hanging out place. Now on the north side, oh, sorry, the south side is what's next. That color comes the sons of Kohath. These are also the same descendants the ancestors of Moses and Aaron and his family. They come from the same family line, as opposed to Merari or Gershon over there. So Moses, Aaron's sons all come from Kohath, but their job is to go in here and take care of this. Anytime they move, Moses, it doesn't, but Aaron and his sons are supposed to go in, take the individual covers, and wrap over or cover up the individual items. So you have the table here, you have the altar of incense, you have the ark, which is inside of there, you have the lampstand. They cover it with cloth or fabric. Well, covering them up, that's because Kohath, afterwards, they come in and actually carry the stuff away. They're not supposed to be watching or looking at the process of covering it up or when it gets uncovered. So only the high priest and his family are the ones who actually do the covering and the uncovering. Everybody else does the actual work of carrying. Yes?
When I was reading, it stated that they made woolen bags.
Yes.
According to the color God told them to.
Yes.
And then they wrapped it in leather and then put it in the pouch.
So right.
Yeah, they covered it with the leather, and then they closed it
in the colored bag.
They could not see or
yes,
anything.
Yes, exactly. So they don't want anybody who is, as it points out, the tail end of verse 20, chapter 4, they're actually doing a kindness to the sons of Kohath. It says, verse 18 of chapter 4, do not let the tribe of Kohath family be cut off among the Levites. If the high priest, the priest, allow them to come in, you will have wiped out the sons of Kohath as the body count piles up. Because they're not allowed to come in there. They're not permitted to go in. So thus you shall do for them, so they shall live and not die, verse 19, when they approach the Holy of Holies, Aaron's sons shall come and assign them every man to his work and his burden. But they shall not come and look as the Holy is inserted, lest they die. So when they put in these items, take them out or put them in, the Kohathites, some of the Kohath are not supposed to be watching it. They don't get to see the components, nothing at all. It's always covered up. Covered up in transport, covered up when they're ready to move, and then it stays that way until the high priests go in and actually uncover everything to use it for its purpose. You noted that, as you pointed out, somebody, the colors. They have lots of colors. Most of the items over here were all blue. Regardless, the lampstand was a blue cover, the incense was a blue cover, and the ark itself has a blue cover. The table of bread was red in cover, and I believe the altar incense was purple. I think it was purple. They had different colors for different assignments.
Is there a reason?
There's two reasons: the practical one and the symbolic one. Practical one: if you don't know what you're carrying, it's just a blue cover. Where does it go? Put it within the blue things. Oh, okay. This is a red cover. Where does it go? Put with the red things. All the red things go together. All the blues go together. The purple things go together. Now, if you actually know what you're doing, other things go with it too. You already know what this item is used for. You can kind of see the image behind, okay, this is a big menorah, right? How obvious is that? I can see it's a menorah behind this bag that it's in. But I can still identify what they are. The physical thing is a color coding process. The symbolic thing is what they mean. We know that blue refers to heaven. Look up. We can see it. It's called blue sky. Blue is heaven. We know red refers to dirt. Look down. It's dirty. It's red. Or brownish color. It's red. purpose was the mixture of both heaven and earth, or as far as a symbolic blend. Well, the altar of incense was supposed to be purple. What is that symbolic? What does that altar represent? It represents your prayers, my prayers, going up to God. That's a time period which we as humans are out of our sins and transgressive iniquities and focusing our attention strictly on God. We have this, hence this sense of holiness during our prayer time. Most of you realize that, right? When you're praying, do you feel like you have God's attention? Hopefully you do. Do you feel like you're worried about the world and all of us care anything else? Hopefully not. The idea is that you are transcending your baseness, your earthly stuff out and going, touching the glimpses of God a little bit because you're mixing both the red, you, and the heavenly blue together, getting purple, which is the incense, the whole idea of prayers going up. So each has their color coding purpose and also their symbolic purpose behind them. And as a result, when they move, Judah moves first as far as the tribes here. Meanwhile, the tabernacle is being packed up and ready to go. They move first, and of course, following them was Reuben, the southern tribes, of course, Gad and Simeon are included. Following them, all the Levites are in the middle. So they're traveling. Let's imagine they're traveling here. I'm going to assume, well, right now it's Judah and his companions on the one side. You got Reuben. You've got Ephraim, or it's also Joseph. You have Dan on the north side. So Judah moves first. They're traveling. They start traveling in a line, however route they are choosing to take. Judah and his companions are in front, then follows Reuben, then the tabernacle with the Levites are all there. Following them, of course, is Ephraim, and then Dan takes up the rear. That's the process of which they travel. That's their progression as far as moving, if they're moving forward, whichever way they're going to move. All this process is done. Of course, symbolically, the God is always amongst them. He's in the middle of them. He's always amongst his people. Yada, yada, yada. We get the idea, hopefully. Okay, let's continue on, though, because there's more stuff here. There's lots of debates on how this all works out, but I'm not going to discuss any more details as far as how they're all camped and their appearances. I'm going to jump somewhere and jump to... Where is it? Oh, Ezekiel. Let's jump to Ezekiel, because there's a discrepancy. I like discrepancies. You learn lots from discrepancies. But I'll say the same thing, you don't learn much. Discrepancy, let's go to Ezekiel real quick. So in this symbolism, we have all these various tribes. You have, obviously, there was an Ephraim side, you have Manasseh was over here. You also had, who was it? Oh, Benjamin. So Benjamin was all on this side. You had Reuben, it was Simeon, and who was the last guy? Oh, Gad was down here in the south. And you had Judah, and you had, Issachar and Zebulun. I'm abbreviating, of course. Ezekiel, the last book of Ezekiel, Ezekiel 48. And, of course, in the north half, you had, Dan, Asher, and Naphtali. So, B-A-N-H. So, Dan's the north side, and it spells Dan. Ezekiel 48, verse 30. Now this is the image of the gates of the city of Jerusalem as far as what Ezekiel's, what the vision he sees. These, the exits of the city. On the north side, measuring 4,500 cubits, the gates shall be named after the tribes of Israel. The three gates northward, one gate for Reuben, one for Judah, and one for Levi. On the east side, 4,500 cubits long, three gates. One for Joseph, one for Benjamin, and one for Dan. On the south side, measuring 4,500 cubits long, three gates. One for Simeon, one for Issachar, and one gate for Zebulun. On the west side, 4,500 cubits with their three gates. One for Gad, one for Asher, one for Naphtali. So, in Ezekiel's image, what he's seeing, he's not seeing this that God created. Which just seems odd. Why would God create the tribes in a particular orientation? And then give Ezekiel an image in his dreams, in his images, which doesn't match what God created initially. Something seems strange here. Well, in Ezekiel's image... Okay, I need to throw that marker away. Put it over there. Okay, so in Ezekiel's image, he has... This is a square city of Jerusalem. Okay, I didn't draw it super square, but it's supposed to be a square city of Jerusalem. I'll move this chart a little easier for some of you to see. This is Ezekiel 48, verse 30 through 34. Actually, I should finish off the verse. It also is verse 35, too. All the way around shall be 18,000 cubits. The name of the city from that day shall be Yehovah Shamar. The Lord is there. Okay, so in Ezekiel's imagery, you have in the north, you have Reuben, Judah, and was it Levi? Yeah, it was Levi. That doesn't, of course, match the Dan, Asher, and Naphtali at all. But that's this is how what the vision that Ezekiel is getting. On the east side, he has Joseph, Benjamin, and Dan. So Joseph, Benjamin, and Dan. And on the south side, he's got Simeon, Issachar, and Zebulun. So Simeon, Issachar, and Zebulun. And then on the west side is a Gad, Asher, and Naphtali. So Gad, Asher, and Naphtali.
What's that?
This is Z. Sorry, I write my Z's with a cross in the middle. Otherwise, my handwriting is so bad, I get it confused with the number two. So, that's such bad handwriting. So that's how we do it. It's seven the same way. So this is how Ezekiel sees. This is Ezekiel. This is 48, verse 30 to 34, 35. That's what Ezekiel sees. This does not match that. As far as why all these things are different, I can't explain everything to you, because I really don't know why. But I do know that they are, in fact, different. One thing I want to point out to you, though, in this, in Ezekiel's imagery, which is different than this one, which I think is why the reason this is done differently, but I could be wrong. What is here in Ezekiel that isn't here in Moses' time? Yeah. Manasseh and Ephraim have been combined. Ezekiel, Joseph is a single tribe, not two. And Levi has been pulled out of the middle and put outside to his own location. So, rearranging this cycle, God took the individuals which Levi used to be hanging out here in the middle, he took him out and combined Ephraim and Manasseh into one, to Joseph. They repositioned him in the process, but this is how they did it. So, in this cycle, when Ezekiel's measuring this, in Moses' time, we can see Levi is responsible for the tabernacle. They can see that all the utensils, all the everything, all the furniture, the whole works. Well, in this one, Levi's not in Ezekiel. Well, who is? Yeah, the Messiah is supposed to be. Levi got replaced with another firstborn. Right? A new firstborn replaced him. This case was Messiah.
Is this in Jerusalem?
Yes, it's Jerusalem. This is the vision that Ezekiel has regarding what Jerusalem looks like. He already finished the previous like four or five chapters. He tells about measuring out the dimensions of all the city and all the details. We won't discuss all that today. But Messiah took the inside. He pushed Levi out. Messiah came in. Well, in the process of doing that, he also combined Ephraim and Manasseh into a single tribe of Joseph. Yes.
After all this stuff happened?
Yeah, this event in Ezekiel has not happened yet, maybe in our history. Right, which we'll discuss that briefly today. I hope so. Briefly, just briefly. So in this process, Messiah came in, he transplanted or swapped out Levi. So we're continuing on this imagery we saw when God said, hey, I killed the first one of Egypt. Then I swapped him out for the firstborn of Israel. I swapped the firstborn of Israel out for the firstborn with one tribe of Levi. I'm now swapping Levi out for the one man Messiah. So I cannot write sideways. So we have this continuous cycle of swapping and exchange that is always happening. And why is that? Well, he's adding, but he's doing something in particular that's different. For example, could Egypt's firstborn have been good servants to God? Could have been, but not likely. Look who was teaching them. They're the gods of Egypt and the people of Egypt. They would not have been made very good servants. The firstborn of Israel, could they have been good servants of God? Maybe. Look at what Jeroboam the first tried to do. Anybody who wanted to follow God, come follow me and we'll go worship God. How well did the northern Israel turn out? Very poorly. So the firstborn voluntarily choosing to follow God doesn't work out so well, as Jeroboam proved. Well, Levi, them serving God their whole lives, how'd that turn out? It also had some serious problems too. A number of the men, high priests, said, yeah, who needs God? I'll move on. We have lots of repetition of cycles of how that happened. See, men following God and always working for him as God is swapping out for better and better, it's never best. So he finally finds one, Messiah, who will work his whole life without fault. That's the best. So you notice the progression of God choosing better, better, best. When he reaches the best point, he stops. Hence where Ezekiel shows up. We've reached the best point. Where now we are at a good servant who can serve the interior and do it right without worry of failure like all the high priests and all the Levites did over time. There's a progression of God's cycle. Yes,
so
Dan.
Does that mean Messiah is going to be the high priest forever?
Yes, he will be the high priest forever. He will always be that continuous cycle. He's always the person between you and God or with God at all times. So when he points out he died, raised the dead, he's at the right... I forgot the quote exactly, I forgot what the address is. He's the right hand of God at his throne. I forget the exact, you know, where it is, but it's recorded in the New Testament as well. So he's hanging out there. The only one who's allowed to be the right hand of God's throne is only the high priest, the Messiah. He's the only one who can do it. Because who else was allowed to go in the Day of Atonement? Only one person could hang out there at God's throne, the high priest alone. So he's going to be high priest forever, a never-ending cycle. Yeah, I have time for this. Okay. Now we have gates of the city named after all of them. I have a question for you. Those of you who can spot this, I didn't at first, so don't be bad if you don't. What gate is missing? I mean, what gate? This is Ezekiel's imagery. In Ezekiel's image, there are 12 gates, one for each tribe. There's one gate missing. Nope, Dan's there too. They're all there. All the tribes are there. What's the gate? That's because in Revelations, when they're counting the 12,000, it doesn't include him because they break up Joseph again in Revelation counting. But these tribes are all listed as far as Ezekiel's imagery. The ones missing, I'll write it down for you because I did. Yeah, it's the Gentile one. Where's the Gentile gate? There isn't one. No. There is no Gentile gate at all. There's no gate. There's no gate allocated to Gentile believers, is there? That's Solomon's temple. We're referring to Ezekiel's image, what God had made up in heaven, and Ezekiel's giving Ezekiel's image, as well as what God even did here in Moses' time. There is no gate allocated to Gentiles. There's a reason for this. We'll say why there's a reason for it. There is no Gentile gate. Now, we discussed this. When we go through these gates, they're named after the 12 tribes. Of course, also the 12 apostles, the stones, yada, yada, yada. It's individual people that they've been named after. There's no Gentile gate on purpose. The Gentiles have another job in this to get into the city. This is strictly symbolic, but the idea is, the concept, which was a vision from this, I'm using the symbolism only, of course. Reuben's descendants would go through Reuben's gates. Judah's descendants would go through Judah's gate. Levi's descendants go through Levi's gate. Joseph's descendants go through Joseph's gate. And Benjamin's gate, and Dan's gate, and Zebulun, and Issachar, and Simeon, and Naphtali, and Asher, again. They all go through their respective gates. Oh, hey, this is named after my great-great-great-great-great-grandpappy. This is our gate. Son, isn't that beautiful? It looks beautiful today. It looks great. They should have polished out this little spider web, clean it all off. But that's what you would look at. You would see your gate, but there's no Gentile gate. Right. What if you don't belong to them? What do you do? This Apostle Paul comes in. He was very adamant about this. Note, in all of these lineages we got through counting, how many women were listed? None. Because it's a patriarchal society. It's designed to be fathers. Fathers define what tribe you're from, not the moms. Let's go back here and erase this real quick. So we have a whole bunch of people. It's designed to be a father of patriarchal society. So patriarchal society means if you're going to be included in a tribe, who does your father have to be? No, part of that tribe. An individual tribe, yes, but part of an individual tribe. If I'm going to be part of Levi's tribe, my dad has to be from Levi. So father... has to be from Levi, else I wouldn't be. What if my mom was? Doesn't matter. My dad has to be. Who's my dad? I know, we're getting there. We're getting there. So if I would Levi, my father has to be familiar. If I would be Judah or any other tribe, if my father has to be there, I have to be a descendancy of. That's why the Apostle Paul was very adamant, called adoption.
Yeah.
There's a big deal. It's called adoption. Let's go there. Let's go to, where is it? We'll jump to Galatians 3 first. Or, 3. Galatians. Galatians 3. G. Galatians. Not Revelation. Galatians. Those small books are so hard to find. Yeah, I'll never remember that. Okay, girls eat potato chips. Okay, all right. So Galatians chapter 3. Record the whole thing, just part of it. This idea of becoming a son or a descendancy. Because if I want in, symbolically speaking, I have to be going through one of these gates. Symbolically speaking, I'm not saying you physically have to go, you can't go, you're barred. No, the point is it's a symbol. So symbolically, I have to get through one of these gates. I have to be adopted one of these sons or one of these descendants of Jacob, of one of these tribes. So Revelation 3, jump to verse, I'm going to read the whole book, just part of it. Verse 6. Galatians 3, verse 6. Say that right. Galatians 3, verse 6. Just as Abraham believed God, it was accounted to him for righteousness. Therefore know that only those who are of faith are sons of Abraham. And the scripture foreseeing that God would justify the nations by faith, preached the gospel to Abraham beforehand, saying, in you all the nations shall be blessed. So then those who are of faith are blessed with believing Abraham. Now, therefore, if I can stop there for a second. In this statement alone, that tells me that in order to be part of this family at all, I don't start with these tribes. I have to go back further. Who do I go back to? Abraham. I go back before this stuff's defined. We'll put it here, do the job board side. I have to start out. Abraham's where I begin. And how do I be a part of Abraham's family? Belief, faith. What does faith mean? It means trust. So, faith is a trust. What am I trusting in? Yeah, what God said he would do. He said he would do it. He's going to do it. I trust that. As opposed to saying, well, I'll verify. No. Trust and verify isn't faith. Trust without verification, you don't actually get to see it necessarily. That's a part of faith. So, faith is trust. Trusting in that God would do it. What did Abraham trust in? The same thing. God said, leave your father's house. Go to land where I show you. It'd be your descendants. The nations would come for you. Kings would come from you. Abraham says, I don't have any kids. I'm an old man. My wife's old. I have no children. What did Abraham do? He still trusted. He still followed and did it anyway. So this process of trust is that you have to believe or trust that God's going to do it. So, am I there? Well, as a Christian, you believe Messiah, yeah, you'd have to be there. You have to believe that God is in fact going to do what he said he's going to do. And what is the promise God gave to Abraham? It was not just land, but land was part of it. Yeah, descendants. It was mostly descendants. Descendants? I think that's how you spell it. Close enough. There's no getting Abraham. Right, we're just going through a step-by-step process. Now, according to Galatians, I have to start Abraham before I can be anywhere around where these 12 men are. So I start Abraham, I go through this process, and the agreement is land and descendants that will continue on with nations and kings and be part of an inheritance. So I have to be an inheritor. Inherit. I have to inherit something. Because Abraham left his stuff to his kids. Now, how many kids did Abraham have? There's several. He had one, Isaac, and then a bunch of others with Keturah and, I forgot the names, a whole bunch of them. He had lots of kids. So if I jump to Abraham and stay there, did I make it? No. Because I may get caught up in any one of his descendants. There's more than one. This promise had to go through a single individual. In Abraham's case, it wasn't through Ishmael. Who was it through? Isaac. So I can't just stop here with the faith of Abraham. Okay, what do I go to next? Because my goal is to get part of one of these 12 guys' inheritance. This is symbolic, of course. One of their, I don't know which one, it doesn't make a difference which one. One of them. So I have to go through Abraham, now I got to go through Isaac. What's Isaac? The son of the promise. Now, in the detail of the son of the promise, I have to be agreement to do something. What was Isaac's agreement? What did Isaac do? Never leave my land. Never, ever leave your inheritance. Don't go out. Don't abandon it. Don't walk away. Never leave. So what do all the other sons of Abraham do? Go away. Isaac, always stay. So Isaac's promise, he goes to Isaac, I have to always stay. Stay. My whole life, which means I've now joined Abraham through faith, but that also means to get the promise through Isaac, I have to do it forever. I don't get to retire when I'm old. I don't get to say, well, I don't feel like it this week. No, it's a forever cycle. You never get to leave. That's the process when you're going through it. All the other descendants of Abraham, what did they do? They left. Went to Seir. They went to the hill country. All over the place. Lots of religions, lots of belief systems everywhere. Isaac's deal was, hey, and God instructed, never take Isaac from this land. He stays here till he dies. That's the deal. You want this promise? It's never ending. So you got the faith, the trust, but you have to trust him forever, as Isaac would do. Trust forever.
That's why that guy had to go get his wife.
Yes, that's it. Eleazar had to go get a wife for Abraham. He could not be brought back to get Rebekah as a wife. And then when there were famines and difficulties in the land, God said, don't leave this land. You can go down to dwell near the Philistines, but don't exit the land itself. Never leave it as long as you live. Or you die. Well, it's part of Isaac's instruction. You go through of his life. He was never permitted to leave the land. He wasn't supposed to. Let's continue on. So I got this part, but is Isaac, if I stay in Isaac, I have the faith of Abraham and stay in Isaac my whole life. Well, is Isaac the dad of any of these 12 men? No, he's not. He's a grandfather of all 12 men. He's not the dad. I can't stay with Isaac. I have to go beyond what he did. So I had the faith of Abraham forever, my whole life, but I have to go more than that, beyond what Isaac went. Let's continue on. Let's jump to, we're still in Galatians. Let's go to Galatians, let's see. I'm going to skip a few details because we just jump through some of this stuff. We'll jump to jump to verse 19. Still in verse, in chapter 3. So Galatians 3, we jump to verse 19. What purpose then does the law serve? It was added because transgressions, till the seed should come to whom the promise was made. It was appointed through the angels by the hand of a mediator. A mediator does not mediate for one only, but God is one. Is the law then against the promises of God? Certainly not. For if there had been a law given which could have given life, truly righteous would have been made by the law. But the scripture has confined everyone under sin, that the promise of faith in the Messiah might be given to those who believe. But before faith came, we were kept under guard by the law, kept for the faith which would afterward be revealed. Therefore the law was our tutor, bringing us to the Messiah that we might be justified by faith. But after faith has come, we are no longer under a tutor, for you are all sons of God through faith in the Messiah. For as many as you were baptized into Messiah have put on the Messiah. There is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, neither male nor female, for you are all one in Messiah. And if you are Messiahs, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. So now we've learned as another detail. This faith that has to continue on forever has rules that went with it. Their instructions. This isn't just a belief, I feel good because I believe. No, it's you actually have to do things with it. It's an instructor. So with Isaac, the promises always stay with faith, but you have to be taught. What is that? What does that mean? What does it look like? Does anybody know what, if without reading the Bible, without reading the Torah at all, what does sin mean? What is doing things right versus wrong mean? What is any of that stuff? Well, if we don't have the Bible instructing us, We have anything you can want. I'll invent this. It's a Saturday, so anybody with the letter S in the name is free. Yeah, it's just arbitrary junk, right? So in this process of staying with the promise of Abraham and going through Isaac's stay always, I have to be taught. Taught what? The law. I have to be instructed. I have to be instructed. What does it mean to have faith in God? Faith in what? What's he going to do for me? What value is that? I don't know. Well, the Torah tells you what value it is. It's called life. Teaches us what life is, what it's like, what it should be like, but how you would treat other people. So taught includes law, how to live. So it's not just belief in God, trusting him always. It's actually living a particular form of life. So it's not just I believe God or believe in Isaac or follow him my whole life. I have to do something. Actually, live something. Be so that you actually know what it is. If you have no idea what you're supposed to live, are you truly following Abraham and Isaac and Jacob? No. You have no knowledge at all. You're not learning anything. So this process doesn't stop here. Well, we have to live something. And we live it. When we've lived it, we've learned from it, when we've learned of it, then we know what our faith actually means, what it looks like. These men, these 12 tribes, they the men themselves obviously lived and died in Egypt, but these 12 tribes, they're being taught something in Moses' time. What were they being taught? The Torah, the law. Well, why are they being taught the law? Sins and transgressions and iniquities. You have problems. You guys aren't living the life that that God wants you to live. They were taught the law in order to learn how to live. How do I live? And this is how you live. Here's your instructions. Follow these instructions. This is what is good. This is what is bad. This is how you treat your neighbor. This is how you don't treat your neighbor. This is how you have your children. Teach your children. This is how you don't treat your children. You get instructions of how to live. So this whole process we're going through with Abraham, the faith of Abraham, it's a building step. It's a building walkthrough. We walk through this process. We learn to live. We learn to live. That's what all these men are doing. Around the temple itself. They've learned or are being taught to live. So this is the process of living. That law is included in it. It's not forever necessarily. Every detail of the law, mind you, I'm not necessarily from the tribe of Levi, so I wouldn't, obey all the Levite laws, but there's a lot of laws in there instructing how to live your life. So it's a never-ending process. And as a result, the tale in which you read just a few minutes ago, verse 29, if you are Christ, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. So in Messiah, I can get this process. I'm allowed to choose to be part of Abraham. I'm allowed to believe, have the faith that he has. I'm allowed to live it my whole life. And I get to instruct in what that looks like, what that means. All because I believe in one individual, which of course was Messiah himself, right? Any questions so far?
Are you still going on with this?
Yeah. Okay. I have more to do. I just didn't lose anybody so far. It's not... It'd be complicated. I just want to make sure I didn't lose anybody. Let's continue on. So let's jump to... let's continue on in chapter 4 of Galatians. Now I say that the heir... Now you're all going to be part of Abraham's descendancy now. As long as he's a child, does not differ at all from a slave, though he is master of everything, but is under guardians or instructors and stewards until the appointed time of the father. Even so, we, when we were children, were in bondage under the elements of the world. But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, that we might receive the adoption as sons. And because you are sons, God has sent forth the spirit of his son into your hearts, crying out, Abba, Father. Therefore, you are no longer a slave, but a son. If a son, then an heir of God through the Messiah. But then indeed, when you did not know God, you served those by nature which were not gods. But now, after you've known God, or rather are known by him, how is it you turn again to the weak and beggarly things, the elements you desire again to be in bondage? So once you've learned this process, you become the heir of Abraham's agreement, or his promise which he got, which was land and descendancy, the inheritor. You get to inherit it. So now we've got this process. It says, as long as you believe Messiah, you get this. You are through these steps. You're walking through these steps. And as you're young, you are learning. How do I conduct myself? How do I live my life? What is proper? What is improper? That's all according to guardians or stewardships and learning what the law says. Live this way, live that way, don't do this, don't do that. How to live your life. So we're all going through the process. As long as we believe in Messiah, we get through the step. That doesn't get us, necessarily, these 12 men and their descendancy. Not necessarily, which we'll discuss that, well, in a moment. Yes?
I thought Messiah was the judge and that we have to be accepted or rejected based on what he says, not by a bunch of gates.
Oh, no, this is symbolic. This is just symbolic. The Ezekiel's imagery is based on the idea that to receive the promise of Abraham, God says, through your seed, your children and such, all this will go through. So symbolically, how does a Gentile receive that promise? Symbolically. I'm not referring to that unless you believe with Reuben, you can't see Messiah. Or unless you believe with Asher, you can't. No, that's not what I'm saying. My point is, symbolically, the idea of adoption has to occur. To be that adopted son. You can't be an adopted son, and who gets to adopt you? Well, Abraham was supposed to adopt you. Is Abraham alive? He's dead. So can he adopt you? No, he's dead. So he can't do it. So somebody has to go through the adoption on Abraham's behalf to adopt you to his promise, not anybody else's. And when they adopt you, you now belong to a patriarchal tribe. Whatever tribe it's going to be. Which tribe is it? I don't know. One of the tribes had to patriarchally say, I will take these people as under my own wing, so to speak. It's symbolism. It's just the imagery because it's a patriarchal society. Notice there are not many women listed. It's listed by the men and their firstborn sons and sons and sons and sons. It is a patriarchal society to know what tribe you belong to. So symbolically, in Jerusalem, you belong to, adopted by, one of Abraham's descendants. And to make that happen, they have to put you into a tribe, say, I belong to this tribe, therefore the inheritance I want to receive applies from the tribe of, I'm just arbitrary, this one. I want this one's inheritance versus that one's inheritance. Make sense? This is what happens any human, every human. This is how it went. So it will always... It's a patriarchal society. In the inheritance process, the tribal-based system. No, this is a very tribal-based book. It's tribe-based. You can see...
Oh, I get that. I'm okay. Just asking you. Yeah. Is
that
the way...
I guess, in manner of speaking, it is, but it's bigger than just this. This is just an aspect or a viewpoint of what is described. For example, let's pretend this tribe here has 4 million... tasks to do. And this tribe here, they lucked out. They only have 3.9 million. Well, I've got 10,000 people. I'm arbitrarily throwing numbers out there. Of that tribe, actually, it records 12. 12,000 of that tribe. 12,000 people to do 4 million tasks. You got tomorrow. Good luck. Go do it. There's a lot of work to do. The point is, they're trying to say, I'm understaffed. I don't have people to complete the job. Messiah says, got you covered. You now have new sons, new additions, new attacks, and to do your task. What are the tasks? I don't care. It doesn't matter. The point is, there's jobs to do. There's assignments. There's work to be done. Everybody has a job or work or assignment, whatever it may be. I don't know them all. You don't know them all. No one knows them all. But there's always stuff to do. So as long as there's stuff to do, there must be workers to do it. How do you get workers? Well, you adopt them if you don't have enough. And how do you adopt them? Through this whole process of Abraham's faith. Those who believed in God, that's where you get the workers from. Where Gentiles come from? Messiah says, I will now reveal the sons of God, as 1 John says. And now you're being revealed. Here's who you are, and lists it all out. So Messiah's intent in John, which we'll get to, is to reveal the sons of God. Well, that's all creation is waiting for the revealing of the sons of God. Who are the sons of God? The ones doing the jobs. The ones doing the work. Lots of work to do. They're the sons of God. How do you get there? Well, if you weren't born in it, you got to get there somehow. You have to be assigned it. How do you get assigned? You have to be adopted. adopted which tribe, depends what the job is. That's your tribe. Make sense? It's a symbolic way of viewing the tasks God has assigned to each of us. We don't know what they are, but or what they're going to be, I should say. But he points out that in John, which we'll get to, the whole point of creation is waiting for the revealing of the sons of God. Well, I became a son of God through Abraham's faith. So I'm one of them. What is my job? I have no clue. I have no clue. It doesn't make a difference. Whatever it is, my job, I'll happily do it, whatever it is. You will have one too. Because no male nor female in heaven. You'll have one as well. So will he, so will he, so will she. What's going to be? I don't know. But it's the idea of viewing the purpose of what these symbols were drawn up for and created for to understand how God thinks. It's how he thinks you can do a better job doing the task, whatever it may be. Yes?
I was thinking we could also, I think, say that the reason why there's no gate for Gentiles is because the actual position of being a Gentile is going to be abolished. Because that means people that are not of God.
Right.
And if you're adopted into,
you can't get in. If you're not of God, you can't get in. Yeah. And that's the whole point of it. That is how we're doing it. There isn't a dropped in by the birdie and drop you in here. There is, once you're adopted, you're in one of the tribes, whichever one's going to be. Because the Gentile doesn't have a reason to enter it. It points out that, I think in Revelation, those who are idolaters and all that are never allowed in. So those who are choosing to stay and live a Gentile life, they're never allowed in. Well, if I want to be allowed in, I have to accept a job to go do whatever he asked me to go do. I'm no longer this. I'm now a son. Which one? I don't know. Yeah, agree. By the hearing, yep. So let's see you on here. Let's see. Ephesians, excuse me, says the same thing. Ephesians 2, we'll jump here real quick. I'm almost done. Ephesians 2, again, another. Girls eat potato chips, right? How does that work? But where's the girls? No, I can't find... There it is. It doesn't help me if I can't find the little one, any one of them. Okay, so Ephesians 2.
You can't find one of the four books here.
You can't find one of those four, yeah. So, Ephesians chapter 2, jump to verse 4. But God, who is written, we're jumping in the middle of an idea of being redeemed and not redeemed and how this process works of being chosen to be part of God's family. But God, who is rich in mercy because of his great love, which he loved for us, even when we were dead in trespasses, he made us alive with Messiah by grace that you've been saved. And raised together and made us sit together in the heavenly places with Messiah. That in the age to come he might show the exceeding riches of his grace in his kindness toward us in Messiah. For by grace you have been saved through faith, and not of yourselves, it is a gift from God. Not of the works, lest anyone should boast. We are his workmanship, created in Messiah for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. Therefore, remember that you, once Gentiles of flesh, who are called uncircumcised, or what is called the circumcision made of the flesh by hands, that at that time you were without Messiah, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers from the covenants of the promise, having no hope without God in the world. But now in Messiah, you who once were far off have been made near by the blood of Messiah. For he himself is our peace, who has made both one and has broken down the middle wall division between us, having abolished in his flesh the enmity that is the law of the commandments contained in the ordinances, so as to create himself one new man from the two, thus making peace, that he might reconcile them both to God in one body through the death, the tree he died on, thereby putting to death the enmity. And he came and preached peace to you who were far off and to those who were near. For through him we both have access by one Spirit to the Father. Therefore you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but now fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Messiah himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom the whole building, being joined together, grows in a holy temple of the Lord, in whom you also are being built together for habitation of God in the Spirit. So we learn from this section of Ephesians that now that we are no longer distinct individuals of Gentiles, we now, there's one and the same. He points out in Ephesians chapter 2 that these Gentile groupings, this category, got deleted, got wiped out, under one condition. Following the commandments that he instructed you to do, you will be inside one of these tribe categories, one of these groups. You're being assigned, this is your new life, this is your new existence. There is no distinction between them anymore because Messiah is the center of it. As we see in Ezekiel, Messiah replaced Levi. So he's all the center of it. So we see this process, this, you, as a fellow citizen, what does a fellow citizen now look like? Well, we learned the fellow citizen required us to have trust in Abraham, or trust as Abraham did, that God would do what he said. We learned we have to do it for always, and we have to learn that there's law, life, living processes that we have to understand how to do. What does this stuff look like? How does a person conduct themselves? How do we get to these tribes, these groupings, in order to be part of his creation, to be part of what he's been building? Let's see here. We're going to jump to, I'm going to bypass Romans 8 because it's a secondary repetition of what I just read. I jump to 1 John. That's important. 1 John chapter 2. Okay, how do you find 1 John? Got a funny rhyme for that one? It's a small. What was that? Okay, go to the end, come forward. 1 John chapter 2. let me read just a few verses on this, of this chapter and then a few from chapter 3 as well. 1 John chapter 2, starting in verse 1 through 6. My little children, these things I write to you that you may not sin. And if anyone sins, we have an advocate with the Father, the Messiah, and the righteous. And he himself is the propitiation for our sins, the offering. Not for ours only, but also for the whole world. Now by this we know that we know him if we keep his commandments. He who says, I know him, and does not keep his commandments is a liar, and the truth is not in him. But whoever keeps his word, truly the love of God is perfected in him. By this we know that we are in him. He who says he abides in him ought himself to walk justly as he walked. So we learn that in creating, in order to be this process of learning this instruction of faith and Isaac's, the promise of always living with it and living a life, following the commandments is part of how this process is supposed to live. In particular, his commandments that he's referring to. Let's continue on. I'm going to bypass some of the stuff because I want to read all these details about love and all that stuff. It's great, but I've got other things to talk about. Jump to chapter 3 of 1 John. I'm going to read the whole chapter. Chapter 3 of 1 John. Behold, what manner of love the Father has bestowed upon us that we should be called children of God. Therefore, the world does not know us because it did not know him. Beloved, how are we children of God? And it has not yet been revealed what we shall be, but we know that when he is revealed, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. Everyone who has this hope in him purifies himself just as he is pure. Whoever commits sin also commits lawlessness, and sin is lawlessness. That you know that he was manifest to take away our sins, and in him there is no sin. Whoever abides in him does not sin. Whoever sins has neither seen him nor known him. Little children, let no one deceive you. He who practices righteousness is righteous, just as Messiah is righteous. He who sins is of the devil, for the devil has sinned from the beginning. For this purpose, the Son of God was manifest, that he might destroy the works of the devil. Whoever has been born of God does not sin, for his seed remains in him, and he cannot sin, because he has been born of God. In this, children of God and the children of the devil are manifest. Whoever does not practice righteousness is not of God, nor is he who does not love his brother. For this is the message that you heard from the beginning, that we should love one another. Not as Cain, who was a wicked one and murdered his brother. And why did he murder him? Because his works were evil and his brothers were righteous. Do not marvel, my brethren, if the world hates you. We know that we have passed from death to life because we love the brethren. He who does not love his brother abides in death. Whoever hates his brother is a murderer, and you know that no murderer has eternal life abiding in him. By this we know love, because he laid down his life for us, and we also ought to lay down our lives for brethren. But whoever has in this world goods and sees his brother in need and shuts up his heart from him, how does the love of God abide in him? Little children, let us not love in word or in tongue, but in deed and in truth. By this we know that we are of the truth and shall assure our hearts before him. If our heart condemns us, God is greater than our heart and knows all things. But if our heart does not condemn us, we have confidence toward God. And whatever we ask, we receive from Him, because we keep His commandments and do those things which are pleasing in His sight. And this is His commandment, that we should believe in the name of His Son, Jesus Christ, and love one another as He gave us His commandment. Now he who keeps His commandments abides in Him, and He in Him, the Messiah in Him. And by this we know that He abides in us, by the Spirit whom He has given us. So, what did we just learn from this? Well, it goes beyond, in 1 John chapter 2 and 3, it goes beyond just the living of the commandments. What did he say? What's the one biggest commandment he pointed out to us?
Love.
Love. So, yeah. How do I get to these tribes? Now, it points out in John 3, it says, the world does not know us. It did not know us in verse 2. Beloved, we are children, and it has not yet been revealed what we shall be. So we do not know what our jobs will be, what we'll look like, what tribe we belong to. We don't know. It hasn't been revealed to you who you belong to. Yes, go ahead.
He's not talking about jobs here. About
what you will be.
Messiah.
What you will be.
No, he's talking about Messiah when he died and what kind of person he is or what kind of a being he is.
Right.
I mean, you claim that he's a spirit, but he's saying that we don't know. When after Yeshua had died.
Read that one more time here. It says, behold, verse 1, what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us that we should be called children of God. It means it's an abundance amount of love that he's done this. Therefore, the world does not know us because it did not know him. Beloved, now we are children of God. It has not yet been revealed what we shall be. But we know that when he, referring to Messiah, is revealed, we shall be like him. We shall see him as he is. So it doesn't reveal what you will be. Well, that is.
It's not talking about a dog. It's talking about what kind of a being he is and what kind of a being he will be.
Yeah, that is a job. What kind of being was Messiah? What defined him? What? How do we know who he is? But what he did? What did he do?
He lived a
perfect life. He cured people. He had healing powers, so he did miracles. Right. If you don't think what I say, at least observe what I'm doing. So we know that he says we will be like him, as you pointed out, as the tail end of verse 2, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. So what is like him? What is he like? Well, he's perfect. He had a bunch of miracles. And loving. Yeah. These are his jobs. This is what he did. It's defined him what he was, right? It's how he lived his life. If he didn't do miracles, if he didn't teach anybody, if he didn't love anybody, we'd be reading about him. No, he'd be just another guy that no one would care about. But he did all those things. We can see what he looked like, but what he did. His actions defined him. It's not they're not referring to what he physically appears like looking at him. Oh, look, he has white clothing. And it's referring to a person is defined by what you do, not what you look like. So all humans are that way. It's defined by what you do. Is you're a mom to your children.
I'm not judging in that respect.
Okay. I don't think maybe I don't fully understand what you're referring to.
This is the scripture that I brought up so many times with you about what kind of people we're going to be, what kind of beings we're going to be.
Like him.
It doesn't say we're going to be spirit. They say they don't even know what we're going to be, but we're going to be like Messiah.
Right. Right. I agree.
That's what the scripture's about. It's about what.
I'm trying to. So in this instance, the scriptures. This is not a physical description per se. It doesn't say what you physically look like. Right, because we don't know what we look like. I don't know. I don't know what jobs I'm going to be doing. Do you? Nope. No one does. So we have no idea what we're going to look like.
Well, I know that's not what I'm not talking about the jobs, and I don't think that is either.
Well, you're talking about resurrection.
flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God.
The kingdom of God, it has, right. We will be resurrected. We die in the flesh and are resurrected in the spirit.
Right.
That's where it's coming from, where he says we're the spirit after resurrection.
Right.
And what does that mean? Well, we don't know that either.
We don't know what it looks like yet. That's true. We don't know what that looks like. What does it look like to be a spirit, no longer a flesh and blood person? I can't see spirits, nor can you, nor anybody else. That's true. But yeah, Christ is able to eat bread as a spirit being.
But in another place, when Messiah came back, where he'd be like that, he's a spirit, but he can eat and drink, and you can touch him.
Right. I'm not arguing that that's not where. I'm not discussing that part of it. That's a physical definition of what something looks like as in person's clothing or what they can physically do. All spirits have that ability. Yeah, we don't know what it looks like.
We're a spirit, and then I would argue that scripture, and you would say no, that we're spirit people. That we're not going to have, when you won't be able to touch or anything.
Simple. To enter into this building, this city, in the temple itself, is flesh and blood allowed to go in?
No.
Some instances they can, on holy days. Who lives there all the time, though? Messiah and who else? Well, anybody, the sons of God, who serve and work for him, because who else works the temple? So you have the people to do that work. And what is there? How do you get that job? Well, you can't live there all the time. Mind you, there's no night there. You can't live there all the time unless you're a condition different than what I look at. I can see my arms. I can see my body. I bleed. I require rest in nighttime. This one doesn't require it. A spirit can live there all the time. Flesh and blood can visit, as it points out in Zechariah. Flesh and blood can visit, but it can't go in and live there. Spirit can live there all the time. The workers of Messiah in these jobs into this city and into the temple itself, who live there all the time, this is my intent, by the way, I'm assuming yours too, to live there all the time. I have to do that in one condition. I have to be a spirit to make that happen. Now, I may or may not be a spirit at the time Messiah shows up. It might be a long time later. I don't know. But at some point in time, that has to happen for me to live there all the time. Does that make sense? A flesh and blood person, as it points to Zechariah, is allowed to visit at holy days and then go home. I would argue, no, he was not flesh and blood anymore. Though he looked like it, they could see the arms, the holes, and whatever else. He was not flesh and blood. His angels themselves were allowed to visit and eat with people. Do angels poop? I would argue probably not. They probably don't. Because their pooping process gets rid of things their body can't consume.
All we know is that they don't recreate.
Yeah, they don't procreate. That's true too. So there's a good chance they probably don't have toxic parts. And I smell today. I don't think angels have the physical bodies that we do. We've discussed this in the past. So just because they consume food, as far as eating food, doesn't necessarily mean that their bodies actually are taking nutrition from the food itself. We discussed this when Ezekiel was talking about the water coming forth from this fountain from the city. And doing for healing of the nations, do angels have owies? No, they don't. They have appendix problems. No, they usually don't, because they're not flesh and blood. They're angels. So all the stuff coming out of this is designed for flesh and blood. So inside the city are spirit. Outside the city isn't. As Ezekiel points out, the ones who are not living in the city, they're flesh and blood. Ezekiel tells us that quite literally. So, we know that there is flesh and blood that still exists when Messiah is ruling inside this city. Zechariah tells us that. Ezekiel tells us that. My intention is whether or not I'm still flesh and blood when Messiah returns or not. My goal, I want to be in here. So, whether I am dead when he comes or whether I die after he comes, my goal is to be inside of here. To be inside of here, there's only one way I'm going to get inside and stay there. The process which Abraham told me to go through. Each person who's flesh and blood out here, whatever city or country they live in, if they want to, when they pass away, to live in here, guess what? Same process I went through, they have to go through. That's the objective. So what will I look like? I don't know yet. So, John, what will we look like? It's not been revealed because we don't know what we'll look like. We don't know what jobs we'll do. We don't know how we will live the life he lived. What tasks? Am I supposed to be a teacher? Am I supposed to be a lover? What am I supposed to do? I don't know. How do I teach? I don't know what I'm supposed to do yet. But we'll be doing something like what he did, whatever his job was. As a spirit being, to live there, you will be doing this work. Most likely, or maybe. I don't know. I don't know what it looks like. I didn't say what it looks like. Whether I'm going to be walking around or I'm going to be hanging out inside. I don't know. Right? But something, in order for me to live there, I can only live there because I can't be flesh and blood to live there. Flesh and blood does not inherit the kingdom. Only a spirit does. So I have to be a spirit to live inside of it. Where I'm going to be doing, how it's going to look like, I don't know. Symbolically, I get adopted by one of these tribes. Symbolically. Because I went the same process they went through Abraham, through Isaac, through Jacob, through the instructions of living life and learning to love. That makes sense so far? Okay, it's a process. I don't know where I will be in or where you will be in, but that's what the process looks like. Hopefully it makes sense. So that's what we're discussing in John. We don't know what it looks like, but it will be something in this category, in this experience, as Ezekiel points out many times, and Zechariah does as well. We're going through this process. And Zechariah explains in chapter 8 that the Gentiles here, who are outside and seeing all this, are going to say, wait a minute, what are they going to do? Grab a hold of the tzitzit of a Jew and say, God's with you. They're going to try to attach themselves, and this the example Zechariah gives, to the tribe of Judah to say, hey, take us with you. So I get to go through and see God also. As Zechariah points out, all the nations will come. They will all have to attach themselves to somebody, adopted to somebody, to get in. If you don't get adopted, there's the door. If you're not going to follow this process to be attached to Abraham's seed, the gate is shut for you. You have to go through the process. If you don't go through, you don't go in. Whether you're a Gentile, whether you're a Jew, makes a difference. You don't go through the process, you don't get in. You can't get adopted. You have to be adopted and you attach yourself to somebody. Adopt me. I will follow you. And so I can come in and visit. I can't live there till I'm dead, but I can come in and visit for the holy day cycle. That's what Zechariah is pointing out in chapter 8. So we have flesh and blood trying to get in to visit God. Right, then we talked. Well, I don't know how that process works. There's difference of opinions on whether or not a person must go through their whole life and die naturally. My opinion is that one, actually. As opposed to someone just miraculously going, poof, I become a spirit. That's my opinion. That I think the person who's out here learning will live a normal, full life. That's my opinion. And then when they die, you get to inherit the kingdom of God. Yes, David.
Come here, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. And he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, having the glory of God. Her brilliance was like a very costly stone, as a stone of crystal clear jasper. It had a great and high wall with 12 gates. At the 12 gates, angels, and the names were written on them, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel. There were 3 gates on the east, 3 gates on the north, 3 gates on the south, and 3 gates on the west. And the wall of the city had 12 foundational stones, and on them were the 12 names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb.
So we know what it looked like. It looks like what Ezekiel saw. So this reiterates what Ezekiel is describing to us, the same thing. It's the same process, what it looks like. And that description points out that the idolaters and all the people don't get to go in. Those of you who don't go through the process, you don't go in. Yeah, no Gentile gate. There's no Gentile gate. So there's no isolated, no priest on the outside, an isolated individual says, hey, you can't be part of. Everything can get in, but you have to get in through one of those gates. And the angels, I'm sure, who were in charge, were probably good enough to identify, hey, you don't come in. Yeah, it wasn't a flesh and blood. Right. So any questions so far? I'm half hour past time. I know. Yeah, a million questions, huh? I realize this is... Grace? Oh, this whole process. If grace, your favor, if I just say I believe in God, what this whole process is a gift from God. It has to be given to me. It points out, not your works. It was, Galatians? Wasn't your works that did it. It's a gift that God has given to you, which had nothing to do with what your tasks are. So this process has to be a gift given to you. Well, grace is abundant favor.
It doesn't have to do with performance, exactly.
No, it's a gift. You have to be given the gift. Just because I say I believe in God doesn't mean I actually do. Just because I do my whole life doesn't mean I actually did. You say, oh yeah, I understand the Torah. I didn't live it. Yeah, you can drop the opportunity to believe. To say I went through steps and did nothing for it. Well, you didn't actually receive any grace. You didn't receive any favor from God at all. Well, the favor is the inheritance we're after. That's the goal. What is the inheritance? Living in here. So we want the inheritance from Abraham. We have to get it because this is what it is. So we want this. Well, if you want to get this, you have to be given to you. It's not an earned thing. It's a gift that God gives. That's where your whole salvation and such has nothing to do with your works. Has to do with a gift that God's given to you freely. That's your benefit. But if you don't do any of this, don't believe, don't follow, do nothing at all, and don't love, why is he going to give you a gift for that? Well, yeah, what the whole process is.
All of our strength and all of our...
You love the Lord your God with your heart, your mind, your body, your strength, and the neighbors yourself.
You'll fail.
We'll all fail.
But he's going to give us grace.
He says there's an advocate when you fail. It was we just read that. I forgot where it was. This is where in John. There's an advocate. When you fail, when you make mistakes, there's an advocate. Say, hey, we'll cover this one. Keep going. That's advocate's job. We'll cover this one. Keep going. Let's move forward. Keep progressing and continue on growing in your knowledge and wisdom and faith in God. Yes, if we didn't have that, he's the one who allows us to go in. If we didn't have it, we'd be up a creek. You're gone. You're done. You blew it.
The whole thing is almost reciprocal. Because you're back into
the law. Well, it is. And from a different reason. Right. It's not a beast because I'm afraid I won't make it. It's because, wait a minute, this is how you love one another. It says love the Lord your God with your heart, mind, soul, and your strength, and your neighbors yourself. What does that look like? Well, I can say, well, I have the emotional feeling of love. Okay. What does that mean? Love is not a feeling, it's an action. It's a thing. You go do. It's action words. So if I'm going to love, what's that look like? Well, he told me what it looks like. It looks like all this stuff here. Yeah, lots of it. This is what it looks like. This is what your mind should be thinking about. This is what your body should be acting on. This is how you should treat one another. These instructions are here, what love looks like in all of its different forms, how God expects it to look like. So if he expects it to look like that, I'm going to look like that and try to read it and try to figure it out and try to follow as best I can. Not through my emotional good feelings, nothing wrong with those, but through what God said, you will love me with your Lord, with your heart, your mind, your soul, and your strength. And this is what it does. And Moses reiterated it many, many, many times. It's more than just your actions. This is your heart, your mind, your soul has to be behind this. Your whole being has to be behind this. And you can do it. So that's the idea of what love is, for as far as God's concerned. Does that make sense? Any questions or comments? Yes.
Kind of encapsulates this all.
Oh.
Where do I share? What is the scripture
that says? Oh, I erased it. What did I do?
Eye has not seen, ear has not heard, neither has it come into the mind of man the things that he has planned for those above.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You don't know all the details. No.
It's way beyond what we...
Yep. Beyond your understanding. Yep.
But he's going to give it to
us. Yes. That's a fair assessment. Typical. Any other questions or comments? Yes. Go ahead, David.
Just a quick comment that, you know, it's sometimes we... You know, we get sidetracked from the key of Yeshua being the teacher of love, putting the whole thing together by showing us how important the love aspect of it is. You know, as they tried in the past to do all these things without love, to no avail.
They stopped here. Abraham, Isaac, whole life, and they taught about the law and how to live. They stop there. And John points out, that's not where you stop. You stop over here. The law, live, love. The love part is where you stop. means not me stop loving. When you've accomplished the idea of loving one another and loving God, that's how you get it. It's a process. I can't go to love God unless I have faith in Him first. Well, again, there's no point in loving God unless I listen to Him and follow Him my whole life. Because that's an example of how I love. So I have to go through all the steps to get here. If I jump here and bypass all that, I didn't learn anything. I have a good feeling. But that's about it. That's not what God is after. It's a process. You go through a whole step. And then when you've reached here, love, you're probably dead now. And you finally made it. Make sense? It's the never-ending cycle. If I stop here, I don't make it to the 12 gates. I have to go all the way to here. And then, as Moses points out, once you've reached this point in love, with your heart and your mind and your soul, you can do this. And now you are the inheritor. You've made it in. It's a complete cycle. I have to go through the whole process. Any questions or comments? We'll close the prayer. Almighty God, our great Heavenly Father, thank you for your kindness in showing us as best we can to understand and follow what is fair and just. Help us, Father, to treat one another well, to follow your ways, to be good servants to you, and to teach according to your will. May you help us instruct our children and our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, the kindness you show us. Help us, Father, to be good servants to you, to love and to trust you. In Yeshua's name we pray. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. Hallel.info.